From inside Irstad Recordings in Peekskill, New York, welcome to A Thousand Exits, a podcast at the corner of martial arts and life's journey.
Here we share our insights into training and talk to those that have shaped our daily practice.
We explore what the martial arts mean to us on a personal level and discuss their broader impact on society and culture. Our passion is the common person's experience in the martial arts.
Bend your legs, plant your feet, relax, and let's go.
All right, guys, I think we're here, we're in it, and let's take off. So welcome, David Wallace, and welcome, of course, to Paco, our host and heart and soul. I'm going to hand it over to Paco right now and let him get the ball going.
Well, hello, Dan. Very good to see you again.
Good to see you.
And today, as Dan said, we have a guest. I could not be happier to welcome today David Wallace to our show. Hello, David.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure.
Really exciting to have you, David. You're our second guest, and I love having people other than Paco and I on because it really sparks, different conversation. That third point of energy really brings something out, and so I'm super excited you're here. I can't wait to learn all about you, and just thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I listened to a couple of your other podcasts, the earlier episodes, and I'm excited for where the conversation will go too.
Thank you, David. And before we go and delve into the fascinating background that you bring, we just have a few updates for our listeners. So first of all, we want to thank everybody. We are blown away by the response. Dan and I still cannot believe it, to be honest. How is it that we have so many downloads, almost today, 320, including with our latest episode, which was the episode on self-exploration, which had a very good welcome. And we welcome today our 12th country, Ireland. So we have a new listener from Dublin, Ireland. And whoever you are out there, thank you very much for joining and for downloading and listening.
Yeah, so if we ever do any kind of world tour, we have 12 countries that we know we can go to.
Dan, I'm pretty sure the world tour is coming just in a couple of weeks. We're just waiting for the quarantine to finish.
That's right. That's right.
So I want to introduce our guest. And, you know, for our listeners, before hitting record, I was talking to Dan about how excited I am. I would be hard-pressed to think of a more fascinating background. So we have David Wallace with us today. He is a doctor of physical therapy, graduate of New York Medical College, and a New York State licensed physical therapist. He's also preparing for his board certification as an orthopedic certified specialist. Being well-versed in martial arts, weight training, and Pilates, David treats patients in a holistic manner, taking patient preference, presentation, and personality into consideration. David has a well-rounded background working surgical and non-surgical orthopedic cases, and particularly enjoys working with martial artists in the rehab setting. Having graduated from the University of Vermont with a VA in Asian Studies, David is also conversant in Mandarin. He has an Instagram page, Stillness in Motion PT. Stillness in Motion PT, and I'll put that in the notes of the show, and his website too. David is one of the most fascinating martial artists that I know. And how is it that I got to meet him? Is that a long time ago, I had contacted John Kaufman, who's a teacher of Wing Chun of the Chusong Ting lineage, because I was really fascinated by some of the stuff that I saw him do online. And I wanted to talk to him and meet him and, one of those very interesting characters in the martial arts that I didn't want to miss exchanging information with, and he responded. John Kaufman was very, very, very kind, and he told me he's based in Hong Kong, but he was potentially going to come to New York at some point. Many months passed. I was training knee deep with my training with George, which is how Dan and I train, and John Kaufman wrote to me saying that he was coming to New York, and if I was interested in just meeting up a little I was, absolutely was. And so when he came to New York, I met with him. I told George, by the way, and a lot of the fascinating things that I learned from John Kaufman that were really very important to me, to realize that there are many ways to do many engines of power that work, and they look very different. So David Wallace was in that group of students of John Kaufman, and I happened to meet him too. And he was local in New York, so that was incredible. And ever since then, we've been in touch, and we've chatted a few times. And the more I talk to David, the more I realize how fascinating his background and his knowledge is. And honestly, I talked to Dan, and I thought it would be a fantastic idea to bring him to the podcast. So, David, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
What an impressive background. And you know what I was thinking? So you like to work with martial artists and do rehabilitation. Have we connected the dots to the character within Wing Chun, Leung Jun, who was a bone setter, and his main specialty was indeed to treat injuries from fights? This is really the first historical character in our lineage in Wing Chun that we can trace to Fat San. And that's basically, you do what he did.
I mean, yeah, 100%. I've actually always, I've heard of a number of people. I can't name them by name, but I think historically a lot of martial artists were kind of part healer, part martial artist, because, you know, you're either trying to tear the ligaments or you're trying to rehabilitate them. You know, it's two sides of the same coin in my mind as well.
Excellent. Excellent.
So David, does knowing that much more about the body make you that much more lethal?
I don't know. I don't like to think of it in that terms. I'm more of a healer, but potentially, you know, I mean, in physical therapy, it's an interesting concept. You know, you have a lot of different interventions in the orthopedic setting that you could use, you know, depending on the patient presentation. And one of them is joint mobilizations. And you're also, you know, as a part of a joint mobilization, sometimes you're checking for joint laxity. If there's a tight joint, you may try to mobilize it. So with that comes a certain sense, a kinesthetic sort of feel you develop for when the joint is at the end of the range of motion, when you shouldn't go further because you're going to hurt the person. So there definitely is some carryover into, you know, a martial setting, because you're developing that motor sort of feel, you know, for what you're doing.
Yeah, and that knowledge. I mean, I'm you know, obviously I'm just kind of joking around a bit, and the reason I say that is because when I think about martial arts practice, I know one spot, which is the chin, which is just hit them in the chin, you know. So it's not very impressive. It's just a straight line to the chin, and then if that's stopped, I'm in trouble. You know, I got nothing else. So, you know, I'm just fooling around with you a bit.
It's worked for a lot of people, I'm sure. No, so it's not a bad thing to aim for.
But you know, what a fascinating concept when we recorded this previous episode, Dan, and we talked about violence. And what an interesting connection between violence and self-exploration, apparently contradictory, right? This is one aspect why when someone in the martial arts is connected to healing, I find it very fascinating.
Yeah, this is really, really interesting to me too. And I've always loved the idea and the image of a person like David who is treating this practice from a holistic viewpoint of not just one side or one angle or one viewpoint, but a total sense of who we are as full physical, mental beings practicing this stuff. So I'm really excited to learn more about that and hear more about that. But before we, as always, we can always just start and get 3 hours in before, you know, noticing it. But before we get too far, just for our listeners, David, maybe you can tell us a little bit about where you're from and your life story, whatever you're comfortable with, and how that brought you to the martial arts, and a bit about that journey. And then we'll see kind of where we go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from, I grew up in upstate New York, in a town called East Greenbush in the suburbs of Albany. Nobody's probably heard of that, but I grew up watching Power Rangers, Ninja Turtles, like a lot of people, and that was really my main inspiration, probably along with Jackie Chan, for martial arts. And I originally started in Shotokan karate. I was probably 5 or 6 when I started. I quit probably 7 years old because I was more interested in soccer, and then I kind of came back at it again in middle school. I trained at same school, American Institute of Japanese Karate with Sensei Shion Butler. Really great guy, really great with working with kids, actually. That was really my intro to martial arts. And he, at some point, I remember, I think I had just received my junior black belt. I was probably in eighth grade. He was talking to us about Chinese martial arts and qi and all like the mystical, you know, aspects of it, which, you know, at this point in my life, I don't necessarily buy into all that, but I have my own take on it. But he was talking about some people being able to like move paper across the floor, you know, to an eighth grader with a little bit of an imagination. I was kind of intrigued, and I went looking, you know, in the capital region, in the yellow pages, because I didn't really have internet at that point. I was looking for Chinese martial arts schools, and I was like, where can I learn how to do this? And so I found a Chinese kung fu martial arts school that I started to train at. I quit karate. And then for the rest of, I would say, high school, for the most part, I did, I trained there. And it wasn't really like a fighting sort of school. I didn't learn anything combative. It was really more of the modern wushu that you see Jet Li trained in. It was very flashy. I was able to do like no-handed cartwheels and whatnot at one point. And that sort of introduced me to Chinese culture, Chinese arts. I developed more of a liking for Chinese arts training there. Unfortunately, I think I was in 10th grade, maybe 16, 17 years old. I tore cartilage in my hip, got injured. And that kind of prompted me to move on. And I started training a little bit of Aikido. As my injuries improved and I went to college, I started training a little bit of Wing Chun at that point and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, my college campus. And that was really when I was introduced to not just Wing Chun, but I had been reading my entire childhood also about internal arts. And, you know, I still hadn't had any real exposure at that point. And I was introduced to John Kaufman, who's I know Paco met and he trained with briefly when he came to the States. What was it, in the fall? You know, that was my first real exposure to an internal art of any type. And it really had a big impact on me and my training, and not just my training, my development as a college student, as a person, et cetera. And you know, I continued to train with John as much as I could. He was living in, I think, Western Massachusetts at that point. I went to University of Vermont for undergrad, and I was from upstate New York, like I mentioned. So, you know, between summer break, all my breaks, I would always drive, and it was great. I would drive to him in Massachusetts, and we would just kind of chill out. We would train for like 4 or 5 hours, talk, train, you know, philosophize about whatever, rinse, repeat, and I would go a couple days per week, and it was great. And then he moved to China, to Hong Kong several times with, I think, the ultimate goal of living there, which he lives and teaches there now full time. And he actually overlapped with him. When I studied abroad in China, and I was living in southern China for about a year, and on one of my breaks there, I went to visit him in Hong Kong. He took me to the Athletic Association. I was only there for like a day or two at the Athletic Association, but it happened to be like of any day you could pick. It was actually one of the days was, I think it, I may get this wrong, I think it was like the anniversary of Ip Man's, I don't know if it was his birthday or the anniversary of his death, but it was just this huge gathering of everybody from the Ip Man lineage, like every famous teacher that I was in the same room as. And you know, I didn't touch hands with them because that wasn't the purpose, but it was kind of cool, cool experience to be there for that. And then, you know, after that, John relocated to Hong Kong permanently, and I had come back to the States, and I was sort of, you know, kind of neither here nor there with my training. I didn't have any real internal Wing Chun people to hook up with and train. I didn't have, you know, a great internal compass as to how to train myself at that point. And I remember John, you know, one of the things he said to me that you know, stuck with me, especially during my 20s, is he said that, you know, the body is the body. If you're not going to train this stuff, there are a finite number of ways you're going to move your body efficiently. So whatever you train, as long as you try to stick by a certain set of principles, you know, it's going to be worth your while, you know. And so I continue to dabble in other stuff and jujitsu. I took a little bit of a hiatus when I was in PT school because it was pretty intensive. But, you know, I dabbled in some boxings. I did some Muay Thai for a bit. I did a little bit of Kyokushin karate. And then I think I had an injury again. You know, injuries kind of shaped my training. You know, injuries, I think, have always been a time for me to hit pause, reflect, why did this happen? How did this happen? Am I not moving correctly? Is there something mentally? Am I overtraining? Why am I overtraining? It's always been a great time for me to reflect. And if, you know, prepping for this interview, when I've been reflecting on my martial arts career, my training, I noticed that anytime I had an injury, it was immediately after that, I guess you could say there was a pretty profound shift in my training and good growth following that as well. And so, you know, in my, you know, mid to late 20s, I was a new physical therapist. I had been dabbling in all this modern martial arts, and between my job, the weightlifting, I was seeing like 20, 25 patients per day, doing a lot of manual therapy with my hands. And I actually developed bilateral medial and lateral epicondylitis, which is, you know, for the layperson, that's tennis elbow and golfer's elbow and both elbows. So any gripping activities, like even at rest, I was in excruciating pain. And so, you know, I really had to reevaluate my career path. I changed jobs at that point. A little bit depressed at that point because I wasn't really training, and I was like, what can I do? And so until that point, I had been a little bit disillusioned with internal arts because I didn't have a good method to train it, and I didn't even know that it was worthwhile to train. I'd been doing, like I said, all the modern stuff, which I think is great as well, but it did force me to kind of reevaluate, you know, what can I do? What can I do? And I, you know, living in New York City, you know, you have plenty of opportunities to look into any martial art virtually. You know, you can find almost anything under the sun in the city. It's amazing. So I thought to myself, I'm living here. I'm not going to be here forever. So let me see what there is, you know, in terms of internal arts and if there's anything worthwhile, you know, because that'll be at least a little bit easier on my body. And so I was fortunate in that I found, his name is Steve Arboleda. He trains at he has a school downtown, rather. He's an acupuncturist. His wife is a Pilates instructor. Wonderful, wonderful people. And they both work out of the same studio in Chelsea, downtown Manhattan. And he teaches primarily Xing Yi Quan. He's an extremely well-rounded martial artist, probably one of the best in terms of like just being able to use it, like fight. He's trained in judo, bagua. He was a really close sort of indoor student with Grandmaster Sam Chin from the Zhongxing Dao Yilichuan system. And so he doesn't teach all of that, but you know, all these, you know, training experiences, and those are just a few. I can't totally speak to his experience, but they've really informed his martial arts, I guess, you know, resume, so to speak, whatever. And so, you know, the way he teaches, it's very sort of like holistic. He teaches in principles, and so he really impacted me, I would say, in the sense that pre-training with him, I sort of didn't know if this internal stuff had any real application, you know, in terms of fighting and actual usage. And I finally met somebody who not only could use it, but all of his teachers and the people that he brought in could use it, and I witnessed that firsthand. And it also, I would say, you know, in terms of training, it changed my outlook as well, because I really started to understand that the forms weren't just, you know, useless movements. They weren't even techniques. You know, Chinese martial arts in particular, I think, is even comparing to Japanese martial arts, the way that they view forms, it's not technique-based. You know, when I say technique-based, you have in karate, you have, you know, geran barai, a low block, you have, you know, middle punch. I don't remember all the Japanese terminology. And yeah, I think they have the roots in Chinese martial arts, but I do think some of these concepts have been lost because they're viewed as techniques in a lot of schools that you go to. And you look at, let's say, Chinese martial arts and Xing Yi Quan, because that's what I'm speaking about right now. But you have Pi Quan, right? Splitting fist. That's not a technique. You know, there's no time that you use Pi Quan versus, let's say, a Beng Quan, which is, you know, more of a punching sort of looking thing. They really, you break them down in terms of vectors of motion, right? So Pi Quan is from up to down, right? But you also have the splitting force. One hand is back, one hand is forward while you're going up to down. In most Xingyi fists, there is a back and a forth, and there is some variation of up and down, down to up, side to side, diagonal down, diagonal up. And so what's really fascinating, when you no longer look at something in terms of a jab across a hook, you start to see that when you're training in terms of vectors and movement, you start to see clear, especially with a rehab background, you start to see clear correlates between, wow, well, if I'm training from up to down, down to up, then these are the muscle groups that will really benefit that. Instead of like, what's going to improve my jab? Well, explosive push-ups or whatever, maybe some form of weight training. Maybe it'll have a carryover, maybe not. But if you're really just looking in terms of vectors of motion, that makes it a little bit more clear cut in how to train. And what's even more interesting, I think at least, is that when you're looking from up to down, down to up, whatever, all of those vectors of motion can be used in striking. They can be used in clinch work. They can be used in takedown. They can be used in groundwork as well, right? So it kind of spans the gap from one area of, you know, combat, you know, no matter the distance, it's always applicable, right? So that was extremely eye-opening to me in terms of training. And it really, you know, I really started to understand and appreciate the value of the traditional martial arts and why train form, you know, why go over the form again and again and again and again, right? So those are all extremely good reasons. And then, you know, after I trained with him for a while, again, I eventually developed some form of injury. I had a sports hernia this time, which is not a pleasant, not a pleasant injury. It's basically a sports hernia is not a true hernia. True hernia is, you know, there's usually some sort of out popping of your intestines through your abdominal musculature. A sports hernia is really more of an umbrella term. It's usually some sort of micro tears or tendonitis of some of your abdominal musculature or some of the muscles in your groin, your adductors. It's an umbrella term. You could be any or all of them. And I had a lot of like lower abdominal groin pain for a good year. And for me, it was tough because I'm a physical therapist, you know, like I need my body to function. So it forced me to kind of take a little bit of a hiatus from more hands-on training. And in that period of time, you know, I didn't want to give up training. So I think at that point in time, it was sort of fortuitous. I found Nima King, who's one of Chushan Kin's longtime students online, had released an online platform for training in that system of Wing Chun. And it was, I think, fresh. Right as I injured myself, I think I saw it pop up on my newsfeed. And I was like, wow. You know, and Wing Chun, you know, as you guys know, the first form, Xiu Nam Tao, is, you know, it's pretty easy on the body. You know, there's no twisting. There's no crazy stuff going on that would irritate, you know, your groin or any other injury. So I thought this might be a great time to kind of reevaluate that because I missed that type of training and now I can come at it with a new perspective. And it was definitely a different experience, you know, coming at it with a new sort of appreciation for form, for what it does for you mentally, physically, whatever. And I would say I did that for about a year. Unfortunately, there's really, you know, outside of Australia and Hong Kong, you know, the Chushan Kin movement, it's tough to find people who train in that lineage. So I, you know, I would dabble around with my Wing Chun, trying to go to here in the city every Wednesday night, there's a free Chisan meetup. I think it's hosted by a traditional Wing Chun group, I think. Great group of people. So I would go to that from time to time. The Wing Chun Brotherhood also in the city, they would occasionally, in the warmer months, they would have meetups probably once per month, Chisao meetups. And it was great in terms of just getting exposure to a lot of different body types, Chisao. The one issue I find, though, when you're trying to develop these internal qualities with Chisao is that it's very difficult when you Chisao with people from a different lineage because their understanding of what Chisao is for is drastically different from yours. You know, like from my perspective, I'm looking for Chi Sao to me is not what fighting is. Chi Sao is developing a body method. So whether or not I can hit you, I don't really care. If I can manipulate your body weight, your center of mass, and knock you off balance, then that to me is that's what I'm trying to learn how to do. But a lot of people from other lineages don't view it that way, right? And that's just, that's personal preference. That's how they see things. I personally, I like learning how to manipulate body weight more because it's movement based. And also from a purely practical self-defense perspective, you have to take a lot of people, this is a little bit of a tangent point here, but when you're thinking about training, self-defense, fighting, whatever, I'm not a fighter. I'm not going to go compete, professionally. I like to train. I like to train practically. But as a part of that, and then looking at self-defense, you have to understand, when you're younger, a lot of people think, you're a killer. You're going to, somebody attacks you, you're going to mess them up, right? You're going to punch them. You're going to beat them into the ground. You're going to throw them on their head. I don't want to do that. If somebody attacks me, I would like to think that, I'd be vicious, but realistically speaking, I'm a nice guy. I'm gonna think twice about punching somebody in the face 10 times. I'm gonna think twice about, doing a takedown that's gonna make them bash the back of their head into the ground because that could potentially kill them, when you're training and you're coming at it from an approach where you want to pummel the guy, like in the Ip Man movie, right? Where you want to punch him 10 times in the face. Realistically, that's probably not even practical from a martial arts perspective. But all that aside, I'm not looking to knock somebody out by punching him 10 times in the face. I'm looking to maybe close the gap, from distance, minimize my punching because that's also a dangerous range to stay at. And once you close the gap, get into a clinch, then hopefully, you get some sort of takedown. Ideally, you stay on your feet and then you get out of there. And if you go down with them, then that's when your jiu-jitsu and your groundwork, I think, is it's good to have a little bit of that in your back pocket. Either way, like I said, it's a little bit of a tangent. But with Wing Chun, that's how my, with Chu Shang Tin, whatever, trying to fit that training into my life, meeting up with these other people, some of the pros and the cons would be I was exposed to a lot of other body types, like I said, different methods, but it was very difficult to develop. So I ended up finding one other guy in this online group through NEMA, and we, pre-quarantine, we were meeting up roughly once per week to train Chi Sao and various, progressive resistance drills, whatever, for about an hour and some change. And then I also, I would say in January, I started training in Yilikchuan, the Zhongxing Dao Yilikchuan through Sam Chin. Like I mentioned, my previous teacher, Steve, had worked in that style. So I had heard of it through him. And honestly, it's some of the best stuff I've encountered in terms of internal, the Yilikchuan stuff. The way that they break down how to move the body, they take this esoteric concept of what internal is and they turn it into almost a science. I think you have to look at, when you're looking to train at a school, particularly internal style or any style for that matter. I think you have to really look at what it is the teacher is trying to teach. Can the teacher do it first and foremost? Is he willing to demonstrate it? Do you believe it? Second, how many of his students can do what the teacher is trying to do, right? And so when you look at a lot of these internal schools, some of these internal teachers, they can do these fancy or these little tricks, which they're not tricks, they're training, they're drills. They're drills to develop internal principles, but a lot of people mistake that for the end result, right? And so a lot of internal teachers can't use it to fight, first and foremost. So if that's a goal of yours, then don't train with them. Second, and probably maybe even more importantly, how many of their students can do what the teacher is trying to teach, right? I don't see many internal schools with a lot of students that can perform at a high level. When I look at Yilikchuan, I see, it's a pretty widespread movement at this point. They have, a standardized way to teach to get to the level of being an instructor. I do see more than I would normally see in terms of number of students and teachers that can perform anywhere from basic internal stuff to even more complicated stuff. Some of these people have competed in Muay Thai bouts and done pretty well from my understanding. Not all of them, not a lot, not the majority. Not everybody wants to do that. But so either way, they break it down very systematically into like a science. They've got, you know, they break the muscle groups down into yin and yang muscle groups. You know, when you're doing some sort of like absorb, they call absorb versus project, you're using different muscle groups, and it's not just your pecs and your abs, it's your whole body, right? It's from head to toe. And ultimately you break it down from one side to the other, but really you're training from, I would say, seven different perspectives, if not more, right? You're training different things separately, but you're really training the same concept. So ultimately there's some sort of convergence. They all come together. And I found that that's kind of been, it's filled in a lot of gaps from all of my other internal and external training. And it's really kind of pushed me even further in the direction of, listen, if I'm going to train martial arts, you know, going back to the vectors versus techniques and movement and training good movement, my focus has really over the years progressed more towards, let me just move well. If I can move well, like that's more than half the battle, moving well. If you can move well and then you add a little conditioning, endurance, strength on top of that, you can make some basic tactics, basic joint work go a long way, right? And if you're not going to enter the octagon, then, you know, who cares about all the fancy stuff, really, you know? And so it was a little long-winded, but yeah, that was kind of my history of martial arts until now.
Yeah, excellent. So, David, you gave us a lot there, and we are fascinated by a lot of the topics you put there. Basically, we're going to try and peel back the onion of some of the things you've mentioned. Dan, I was looking at Dan, and I know my brother very well, right? My Kung Fu brother. So I know that he's like, oh, damn, I wish I could ask this and go deeper there. So we're going to try and do some of that. So one quick thing to just probably mention, because I think it's important, even if it's probably less fascinating than a lot of the internal aspects that you've mentioned, but forms and studying online, because of the quarantine, shelter in place, I think it's worth taking 5 minutes. You know, I was pretty skeptical when it comes to training solo and using online resources. And gradually now, I'm realizing there's a lot of value for solidifying some of the basics, especially if you have a background and you know you have a foundation. So maybe you can give advice to our listeners out there that are, you know, stuck indoors and not really sure about how to keep develop the martial arts practice.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's a challenge. And I would say, you know, I personally feel there are so many aspects to be developed, training solo, training on your own. Depending on who you ask, you know, I think a lot of traditional martial artists like traditional martial arts precisely because there's so much material to develop and train on your own. And so I, going back to what I mentioned earlier about, you know, John saying, you know, if you can't do internal, you can't find a good internal teacher or school to train with, just train whatever you can, because there are only so many ways you're going to move your body efficiently. And it's really all the same at the end of the day. Efficient movement is efficient movement. And I would take that advice and apply it to everything, right? And it's like, it's an old like Kung Fu karate cliche, right? You look at the Karate Kid, the older version, right? With Ralph, what's it, Macchio, and then you've got the newer one with Will Smith, the one Will Smith directed with Jackie Chan, and you got the training where they're scrubbing the floor, wax on, wax off, right? It's kind of like a cliche, and people laugh at it, but it's 100% true. You could, you know, training in isolation. If you're a parent, you could work on body mechanics pushing a stroller, right? Are your forearms or your shoulders getting fatigued when you're pushing the shoulder, or are you engaging your core? Are you using your whole body, you know, or is it going to your lower back? When you open a door, the same thing. You could apply it to weight training too. I'm a big fan. I train every day. Most days I do martial arts training on top of physical conditioning. Some days I only get around to physical conditioning, but I still consider that to be training, you know, because I apply the same movement principles when I do my kettlebell workouts. I do Pilates sometimes. I run. I have a stationary bike, and it's the mechanics and the principles of movement are really the same. And if you can get those principles, I think you can really just apply them universally, and you'll feel better, you'll move better, your martial arts will be better. I would say that's a good place to start. You know, if you work on your breathing, work on moving from your center, pick a couple of parts from your martial arts, your practice, your form. If you do jujitsu, you know, work on your shrimping, right? Just work on your bridging, your shrimping, and try to move from the core. Are you breathing? Are you holding your breath, right? If you're doing Muay Thai, the same thing, you know, can you throw your kicks? Can you do your, you know, your punches? Are you moving from the center? You know, you have to be honest with yourself. Do you feel it all coming from your center? If not, slow down, right? For a traditional martial artist, it's a little bit easier. You just pick a segment from your form, you know, and you can have people, you can do progressive resistance, you know, have somebody try to resist you as you slowly throw a punch. Is your shoulder fatiguing? Is your lower back taking some strain, right? Or does it feel effortless, right? Are you breathing? So they're all, I would say, to train on your own. There are just so many facets to train. Now is a great time to, you know, sort of broaden your knowledge base and your experience. You know, there are plenty of online martial arts courses, plenty of online Pilates courses. It doesn't have to be martial arts. I think there's a lot of carryover from exercise to martial arts and vice versa.
So this study of deep movement, how it works and how it connects with the rest of the being, is that why do you think the founders gave us forms so we can do this for the time of quarantine? Because there's a lot of movements they were training for that were not the natural, or at least not what we do on a daily basis, right? So a little bit of a rewiring of what we had to do in the practical context, because it's not really what you do in day to day, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I agree. I think forms are really, it's a time for you to try to you said it very well, how to reprogram how you move. So when you're training form, you know, and you're trying to learn to move from the center, you're basically trying to stop moving so much from your extremities, stop generating force from your shoulders, from your pecs. And it's not to say, you know, I made this mistake many times myself. You're also not exclusively using your core. It's a common misconception. Core strength, move from your core, right? I've even said it myself, that you want to use your whole body together, right? I've made that mistake time and time again. And I've had a lot of overuse injuries because of it, because I've, you know, and I'm a rehab professional, and it took me time to figure this out too. You know, you move from just your core, you're going to end up with a sports hernia like I did, right? Too much core. So yeah, I think the forms are very well, you know, training form is very well sort of suited towards rewiring your nervous system if you're doing it with those principles in mind.
This makes me think of a quick question about how your own martial arts and healing practice intertwine with your job. And how do you personally balance this really physical martial arts and healing practice and exercise routine practice that you have for your own development with the fact that, like, you're probably going to go work an 8-hour shift manipulating other people's bodies? And do you have any kind of thoughts on how to structure that for other people who, say, want to practice one of these martial arts and then they're going to go off to a construction job, or they're going to be waiting tables on their feet, you know, full time? Obviously quarantine's different, but you get the point of what I'm asking.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. It's something that I've had to really figure out as I go. I've been practicing for about 5 years now, and it's been a process figuring it out. I initially started out working in a clinic. I mentioned I was seeing 20, 25 patients in a 7-hour period of time. It was a mill. You know, it's a lot of that's a byproduct of our insurance system, but not getting into that. But
yeah, we'll talk about that in our political podcast, you know?
Yeah. And at that point, I was also, it was an orthopedic clinic, and I was getting, at that point, I was a little more interested in hand therapy, and it's still an interest of mine, but I was seeing, you know, 50% of my caseload, maybe more, give or take, depending on the day, was upper extremity, meaning, you know, mainly elbow, wrist, and finger. And so when you're going to do, for anybody who does body work, massage, or physical therapists, OTs, whatever, whoever's listening to this, you know, it's a lot of work for your hands and your forearms. Whereas if I get a low back patient, I can dig my elbow or my forearm into them, or I can give them a lacrosse ball, and their body weight on a lacrosse ball works wonderfully. But it's tough sometimes to get people, you know, if you're going to do some sort of manual technique, you know, it's a lot of wear and tear. You combine that with weightlifting, with training, you know, it's a lot of load for the tissues in your forearm. And so over time, yeah, you're not giving yourself time to recover. So how do you balance that? So, you know, comes down to sacrifice, I think, on some level, and priorities in life. So I, you know, I personally, I've had to, over the past 5 years, you know, reevaluate a couple of things. And so I remember listening to some of Ian Abernathy's podcasts. You know, for those of you who are unfamiliar with him, he's a karate practitioner in the UK, has some really phenomenal stuff out there. But he often says that for him, his training needs to be both life preserving and life enhancing, right? So a lot of us as martial artists get too fixated on life preserving and the very narrow sense of life or death, right? So, you know, in terms of self-defense, fighting, combat, statistically speaking, and I, you know, I haven't read the statistics directly, but, you know, I'm in my early 30s. I can count on two fingers how many times I've been in, you know, a situation where I may or may not have needed to rely on martial arts. Once was in fifth grade, and once I was in China, and I avoided conflict. So, you know, it's going to depend on your demographic, where you live, your job. But the point being is that, you know, if you're so fixated on life preservation in terms of, you know, I need to defend myself tomorrow from a threat, somebody's going to mug me, you know, you're going to be prone to overtraining probably. I see this all the time. You go on Wing Chun forums or on Facebook groups, whatever, and people are always so fixated on the fighting. And yeah, it's a big part of martial arts, but it's not the only part of martial arts. And I think when you get stuck in that, you know, there's a lot of stress that comes with it too. So I think for me, to answer your question about how do I balance my life and my training, and how many other people balance their life and their training, it's priorities, right? And you have to do a little bit of soul searching and be honest with yourself. If your goal is to be the next, you know, Conor McGregor, you're going to have some sacrifice maybe of your health, right? Yeah, you're going to be tired. You're going to be injured. If your goal, though, is to enjoy training and to be able to, you know, defend yourself a little bit, right, and have fun while you're doing it, you don't need to go train at an MMA gym necessarily, right? You don't need to kill yourself to do that. There are a lot of things to weigh when you look at that. And so for me, the emphasis has always come down to, like Ian Abernathy says, life preserving, not in the sense of strictly, am I going to die if I get into a fight, but life preserving in terms of, like, when I'm 80, I want to be able to move well and keep doing this, right? And also life enhancing. Do I feel good?
So I had a question, because of the three of us, I am absolutely the least informed in terms of martial arts history and background. So David, you've mentioned a lot about your need to learn the healing aspects of the body and the mind, partially through martial arts, partially through other methods. And a lot of the impetus for that was the injuries that you sustained on your own while training. And I'm curious if either prior to those injuries or after, there was an awareness on your part, or I'm sure there is now with your level of expertise, and Paco with your understanding of the history of martial arts, how healing played into martial arts training and philosophy from, I guess, maybe the beginning of their founding or throughout the history of their practice, beyond as a means of recovering from injuries sustained through practice or through combat in some way. So there's obviously, like, the kind of physical injuries you're talking about, and then you need a way to heal from those and continue to develop in your practice. But my experience in a lot of, and I think we should take a moment at some point to define what internal martial arts means versus external, because I think it's probably pretty nuanced, and the image that I often have in my head is not nuanced, but I'm guessing it is more nuanced than that. But my experience, I practiced Tai Chi for a little while, and was that the healing aspect, the life enhancing aspect that you're talking about, is a huge component to these martial arts in a way that seems to go beyond simply healing from an injury that you got from the martial art or from life. There's some, like, I remember some of the first explanations of Qi that I was given when I practiced Tai Chi. It was really about how to make this robust energy a part of your life as a whole, but that was also interwoven into the fabric of the martial art itself. And I'm wondering if you could, if you, either of you guys can talk a little bit historically about how health practices mirror and combine with combat practices in these martial arts.
And I think David has a lot more to contribute, but I will just speak 1 minute. One of the things I'm fascinated with is the history of the martial arts. And I barely starting to delve deep because there's a lot of myth also. And there's a fascination with the true history. This is one of those cases for me in which reality is stranger than fiction. So we don't need the fiction. The truth of it is pretty incredible. So we do know that in the history of Wing Chun, we do know that Liu Zhang was a healer. That was his job. That's how he earned a living. But something happened that we tend to ignore. One of his disciples was Chao Washan, and he was a teacher of Yip Man. And Chao Washan was a money changer. So influenced was by the healing profession of Liu Zhang that he changed his profession. He learned to be a doctor. As much as he was learning Wing Chun, he learned to be a doctor and he changed his profession when he was an elder an older gentleman. He actually was known as a doctor, just like his sifu was. So what happened there? What's the connection between martial arts and that big change in life? And now I'll let David talk, but I'm fascinated by that point of history.
Sure. You know, martial arts has plenty to offer in terms of injuries, recovery, training. How does it prevent injuries? How does it promote health? You know, I think that's, you know, it's a huge topic. And I'm unfortunately not as well versed as you, Paco, in history of martial artists. But, you know, I would say just off of my, just with my experience, my exposure, there's so much it has to offer. In terms of, you know, thinking about, you know, it's kind of a loaded question in a sense, if you think of it from, because we're all speaking from a Western perspective, right? And I'm used to thinking in a Western perspective, cause and effect. How do we prevent, you know, if that means there is a cause, and how do we, you know, intervene to maintain health or prevent disease, right? But I, you know, not being an acupuncturist or extremely well-versed in traditional Chinese medicine, or any variant myself, my basic understanding is that they don't really view it in terms of cause and effect. They kind of view it in terms of what is right now. Meaning, you know, you have a microcosm, which is your body, and you have the macrocosm, what's going on around you, your environment. So they look at things like humidity, dampness, dryness, heat, excess cold. I've read a little bit about this. I'm by no means an expert, but I find it fascinating. I wish I had the time and money to go to acupuncture school, fully understand it. But you know, the way they view it is what is. So I would say, what does martial arts, the practice of traditional martial arts have to offer you in terms of health, wellness, promotion? I think it's teaching you to listen to your body and what is, right? You know, so you're training and you feel a little bit of low back pain. It doesn't mean you're going to have low back pain. It doesn't mean you need to prevent low back pain. You have low back pain, right? You know, so move differently, right? It's a kind of simplistic way of looking at it, but and there's much more to it. You know, if you're really opening up Pandora's box when you're getting into Chinese medicine, because you have nutrition as well. To them, food is medicine, right? You know, how is your diet? How is your sleep? There's so many, you know, so when you really look at what is when you're training, look at all the fitness trends. I really do honestly believe our modern understanding of health and medicine is slowly sort of converging towards that understanding too. It's a little bit Western, a little bit Eastern, in my opinion, at least. So, you know, in terms of martial arts, you know, it just really, if you practice it in a traditional sense, if you incorporate some of the traditional aspects of martial arts, like Qigong, I love, you know, it really just teaches you how to listen to your body, how to breathe, what's working, what's not working, right? And over time, the real value in it isn't like, you don't just go through the motions and you get all the benefits, right? It's not like taking medicine like that. The real value in it comes from doing in it, being in the moment, seeing what is. And over time, you start to see what is and how that correlates with how you feel, right? And it becomes more of an experiential sort of process, I would say. Yeah, that's my two cents on it. Historically, I can't speak to it as much, but experientially, you know, can't really say clinically because it's not a part of my practice, but
yeah, it seems like one of the things I'm getting from you by listening to you is a sense that your practice has a great effect on your life as a whole. Like there's a holistic sense, because you were saying, like, I have, it's funny you mentioned it. I have a young daughter. She's just a little over a year. So you were saying if you're pushing the stroller and you feel fatigue in your arms, you know, could you feel and sort of analyze what you're doing and how you're moving, what your posture is? And I think it's just really interesting that what you learn in your training, and especially with your profession, is something that it sort of blankets out and encompasses all of your life experience. And I guess I say that because from my perspective, I very much compartmentalize things. So when I practice Wing Chun, it's like Paco's coming over from 10 to 11, we're practicing Wing Chun, and then it's like the light switch goes off and I stop thinking about what I learned during that session. My body stops sort of analyzing itself or observing itself in that way. I think there's I did a little bit of form work before we all met today, just because I thought I should, you know, we're going to talk about martial arts. I should probably practice some martial arts. And, you know, I noticed even just doing one form for 5 minutes, there is a leak out effect into the next few minutes or hour of my life. And then it's like almost like a door starts closing of that energetic experience, because I only did X amount of, you know, workout. I'm only doing it once or twice a week instead of every day. But I really like this approach you have, or this experience. I feel like you're communicating that, you know, you're feeling and experiencing and thinking about these things in such a total and holistic way that the benefits can cross over for much longer than if it's like me, where it's really compartmentalized. You know, it's just a little bit of time each week, and then I'm kind of like, I turn off the light switch, and then I'm not really feeling or experiencing that later. I'm probably not getting that full benefit of analyzing how I'm moving and feeling when I'm lifting my daughter or pushing her in the stroller. And, you know, I personally have a lot of physical discomfort, and I think I could probably benefit a lot just by, you know, listening to kind of what you're saying there. I'm wondering, Paco, would it be okay for us to go way back a really fundamental basic question that I think might be interesting for some of our listeners, which is, David, can you define to the best of your ability and the best that it can be defined what internal martial arts are, or what the difference is between an internal martial art versus what you would think of as the opposite of that, is an external one? And I also think it's really interesting that you've mentioned internal Wing Chun, right? You've said sort of like an internal approach to Wing Chun. So even in styles that appear more practical or straightforward on the surface, there are versions and variations and outlooks that are internal. And I'm wondering if you can define, just at the most basic level, what does an internal martial art mean?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a very tough question. I would say, you know, there is no internal martial art. You know, that's a thing, right? There is such a thing as internal training. And I would characterize internal training as any sort of physical training that's introspective in nature. You know, you look at some high level boxers, you know, high level UFC fighters, they probably haven't ever learned any form of internal martial art. They, you know, they have, I think in boxing, what is it called? They call it short hands, I think, right? Meaning they can generate power from a short amount of distance. You know, what's the difference between that and a 1-inch punch, right? You look at jujitsu, you have invisible jujitsu, they call it. You know, it's just good body mechanics, which comes after hours and hours and years of training with really, you know, concentrated thought on how am I, you know, in introspective thought, how am I moving? You know, why does this work? Why does that not work? It helps if you have a basic understanding of science, levers, anatomy, sure, but you don't need it. You look at Chinese martial arts and they have their own terminology, which is difficult to understand if you don't understand Chinese culture, right? So to me, an internal art is just, it's kind of like I've heard people talk about Sistema. I used to listen to a couple of Sistema podcasts, and you know, some of the people who have kind of cross-trained in other boxing, MMA, have done Sistema, they've really said that, you know, Sistema isn't going to necessarily teach you how to fight on its own, but they feel that it's almost like getting a PhD in martial arts and movement.
So the idea of an internal practice of some sort, in your mind, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that necessarily tied to in this context of Chinese martial arts, let's say, is that necessarily tied to the experience or concept of qi or energy of some sort? It sounds, the way that I'm hearing you describe it, it's almost like the process of introspection in any form creates the conditions for a kind of internalized practice or training situation. And I'm just curious if it necessarily translates to something like the experience of qi flow. And my very limited understanding of qi from my practice in Tai Chi or Wing Chun, the description through a sort of Taoist lens is this, you know, internalized energy that's flowing through all of us, a kind of life energy. And it's tied to the breath. And there are a lot of different descriptions, but in some ways I think energy might be the simplest word for a non-Eastern philosophy or practitioner to understand. But so my question is, does it necessarily tie an internal martial art practice? Does it necessarily tie to the experience of qi, or is it broader than that?
I would say, you know, in order to really answer that question, you have to really delve into what is qi, right? Or qi, right? If you're a Japanese martial artist.
Which I would love to delve into because I think this is a great opportunity.
Yeah, you know, my Mandarin is super rusty. I used to be pretty fluent. But, you know, qi, the word qi, at least in modern Chinese, people don't walk around talking about qi in China. They, you know, the word itself is used in a number of different contexts. And if I remember correctly, some of those contexts, you know, air, breathing, right? You know, there's also a concept that qi has very much to do with motion, mobility, right? Where in Chinese medicine, where there's a stagnation of qi or a lack of movement, you have pathology, you have disease, right? And I think that kind of holds true in the Western medical setting too. You know, you stop moving, you know, depending on, you know, some other maybe predisposed genetic issues or maybe your diet, whatever, you could be putting yourself more at risk for cardiovascular disease. You could be even not moving enough. You know, you lay in bed for 2 days straight. It's not good for your intervertebral discs in your spine, right? So lack of movement across the board is not good. Leads to atrophy, lots of things. So qi in general, you know, if you accept the idea that qi literally in the very simplest sense just means motion, move, right? You know, then, you know, by nature, any activity you do is going to be an experiential thing with qi, as long as you're paying attention to how you move, right? That's my take on it. In terms of, you know, do you need to think about qi in the traditional sense from a Chinese perspective when you train martial arts in order to train internal arts effectively? I personally don't think so. I think it can be very misleading and confusing. So the idea, you know, with Chinese medicine, their concept of qi, it's just another way of, you know, conceptualizing health, movement, wellness, right? And so if you get kind of lost in you know, the forest for the trees, it can be confusing. And I think a lot of people in the internal martial arts world get very caught up on this concept of qi, feeling the qi and, you know, Dragon Ball Z, whatever, you know. it's at the end of the day, it's movement. And it, you know, it's, I think any of my teachers that I've mentioned so far in this conversation, none of them, they're all Western, but they've all trained with Chinese people, you know, Chinese teachers, some of them from Taiwan. So, and even their teachers don't really say, you know, use your qi, this or that. Maybe they'll reference qi occasionally just because it's a part of their language, Cantonese or Mandarin, but it's the Western teachers, John Kaufman never talks about qi. Guy Steve I trained with, extremely good martial artist, he's an acupuncturist, he doesn't talk about qi when he trains. You know, the guy I trained with in New York City in the Zhongxing Gao system does not talk about qi either. He talks about good movement and how to coordinate movement and gives you a lot of visual, verbal rather, and visual cues in order to get you to think differently about your body and about movement differently. And that changes your muscle activation, which you also see a lot in Pilates.
Yeah, I really like that because it seems like how you've framed an internal quote unquote practice for us, as well as this idea I'm asking about with of qi, it's actually a much more open and workable definition. And it also, what I like is that at least with a word like qi, it sort of brings it to a more humble level of what it could or could not mean in the larger context of life or practice. And I like that because, you know, I, just like you, I was always obsessed with like all of these various ideas and experiences in martial arts. And, you know, I see a lot of different practices that, I don't know, maybe they hype up the idea of qi to a point where, it's something that's not workable or usable or practical in the way that you're describing it. And the way you're describing it makes it all sort of brings it down to earth into something that is a little bit more fused with what is real life seems to be. I don't know. That's just my personal opinion, but I like that. I get a lot of relief from hearing that kind of discussion of it.
And then you have something very practical like Marty Anderson, a student of Chuson Ting. You know, when you have this skill you're describing, you can use it in fighting. And this person is just a fighter, you know, unstoppable one. So that connection is there because we don't want the listeners to think that's not the case. It's just your choice. It's healing, it's efficient movement, it's fighting if you need it. Like you said, you can see that skill in boxers and UFC fighters, right?
Yeah, and I don't know too much about this. So if there are BJJ guys or girls out there who do, you know, just forgive me. But in some of the documentaries I've seen on like Hicks and Gracie, it seemed like a large part of his practice was about softness, internalization, meditation, flexibility. It's not about even necessarily the martial arts component of it or about combat, you know, or strength training. It's about this fluid kind of experience, and a lot of that seems to be about with that introspective work, which is really nice.
Totally. I mean, if you look at there's so many people you could look at, the top fighters in UFC, even like Conor McGregor. You know, if you look into how he trains, yeah, he trains on a heavy bag, he does conditioning, but like a lot of his training has also been very much focused on just moving in as many different ways as possible, feeling the connections, right? I haven't really followed all the fighters, so I can't, you know, speak to each of them, right? But, you know, I've had a lot of exposure through, I keep going back to Steve Arboleda, right? He, one of the guys, he has come in yearly for a seminar. It's Tim Cartmell. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a longtime Chinese martial artist. He lived in China for, I think, at least a decade, studying with all the various internal arts. From my understanding, he competed and did pretty well with his stuff in a lot of Sancho tournaments. And these days he lives on the West Coast. He, you know, he's a, I forget what degree, black belt Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And he's an MMA coach. He teaches MMA fighters how to fight. And he tries to incorporate a lot of these principles from my understanding too. And he's, you know, he's also a great, you know, great guy to look into. You know, I think he's been interviewed on a couple of podcasts, has some very interesting insights on just the usage, you know. But at the end of the day, it's all movement based. I remember he came to give a seminar, and before the class, when he was warming up, he was just doing a lot of calisthenics, but, you know, body weight exercises that are really difficult, like going from a frog stand to, you know, a partial handstand. And the guy is, you know, he's not young and he doesn't look physically imposing, but he's incredibly efficient with his movement. So at the end of the day, yeah, because I think it does come down to just move as much as you can and as many different ways as you can, maintaining the same principles. And if you want to fight, you could use it to fight, right? You have to train your tactics. You have to train angles of entry. You have to train, you know, different things to make it applicable. Absolutely. You have to train using it under pressure, psychological and physical. But you could also, you know, if your thing is football, you could do it football. If your thing is dance, or your thing is gymnastics, you know, it's all the movement is the same. It's just the application is different.
And you've mentioned earlier that you practice Ilichuan. And I think for our listeners, they may not be familiar with this practice. I had not heard it until you mentioned it. As a student of Wing Chun or Chusunting Wing Chun, but also Ilichuan, do you conceptualize these two as practicing the same fundamentals? Or are there two different arts that are giving you something different? And what is Ilichuan?
Yeah, I mean, so I started training Ilichuan just this past January of 2020. So I'm definitely a novice. So I can only speak, you know, from my experience. I'm definitely not speaking on behalf of the art itself. But, you know, Ilichuan Yi is like intent, leak or li is in Mandarin versus Cantonese is strength, chuan is fist, right? So like many internal arts, it's some combination of intent plus strength or intent plus shape. If you're talking xing yi chuan, right? There's always intent plus something, right? And a lot of these internal arts, whether or not it's in the name. And so, yeah, it's an internal art. It's also, if I believe it's from Southern China. I read a little bit on the history of it. It was, I think, more of like a sticking hand art like Wing Chun, and it still has sticking hands. It's a little bit different from like the Yip Man type of sticking hands, and their definition of like center lines and where you want your hands to be is a little bit different. So I'm actually still trying to reconcile the two in some ways and trying to figure out like conceptually, you know, how they're consistent with each other and how they're different with each other. Overall, you know, my experience, this may get me in trouble, but my experience is that they, you know, they're saying a lot of things that are very much the same. Chusheng Tin lineage, Wing Chun calls things by different names. They give you different verbal cues to think about. You're moving from, you know, they talk more about Taigong, you know, pulling up from the anus area, right, is like the main sort of thing. In Ilichuan, you also do that. They call it something different, but you're not just doing that. And so I think their approaches in teaching you how to move are definitely a little bit different. There's some variation with that. Chusheng Tin lineage Wing Chun is more coming at it from the relaxed perspective. And so and it's an interesting concept. You know, I've seen this sort of differentiation in different internal arts. Some arts like Tai Chi, Chusheng Tin lineage, Wing Chun, they approach internal training more from like the relaxed perspective, meaning like relaxation is the most important thing. Problem is, if you're too relaxed, you fall apart, right? And so you kind of have to learn by trial how much is too much, you know, how much tension you need, right? It's all about controlled tension at the end of the day and in whole body tension, right? But not too much, right? Otherwise, you give somebody some sort of board to push you, right? Or a place for them to, if you have tension in your body, they can manipulate that tension, use it against you, basically, right? So then you have Ilichuan, where, you know, you don't want to be overly tense, but they teach you how to access certain parts of your body by using muscular force, right? So some of the basic exercises, which are really just Qigong exercises, you know, I haven't really even learned much about the first form. There are only two forms, to my knowledge, in the system, and there are a lot of basic exercises you do. It's very simplistic art, like Wing Chun, in terms of like there's not a lot in terms of forms, which I love because it's just the principles, right? So the basic exercises, though, you know, you focus on using certain muscle groups together, and at first it's really hard to use them all together. So you maybe just work on one, maybe two. Use them together over time. You know, in neuroscience, they say muscles and nerves that fire together wire together, right? So after a few weeks of that, it gets easy and you can do it volitionally. It doesn't take so much thought, right? And then you add another muscle group, and then you add another one, and then you add another one, right? And then you're pretty good at that muscle group, and then you have to work on the opposite, right? Which ideally you've been working on the whole time, just not simultaneously, right? And then eventually over time, you realize, wow, when I activate these muscle groups, the other ones also work too. Cool. I've been training the same thing the whole time from two different perspectives, right? So, but they're coming at it from the angle of tension, and you get tension, right? Once you're adequate at using that tension simultaneously everywhere, then you can tone it down a little bit. Because the idea is that you need to have the tension balanced. The tension needs to be balanced everywhere in your body, right? If there's too much tension in one area versus the other, it's not so good, right? Somebody can take advantage of that. And nobody's perfect, so that's really the art at the end of the day, balancing your body through controlled tension. And Wing Chun, Chu Sheng Tin Wing Chun, I would say is the same exact thing. They just have a different method of training it. They come at it from the relaxation approach first rather than tension. And eventually, you have to have some tension. Your muscles have to work, right?
I was actually very impressed when you sent me a few videos because you told me about Yili Chuan and I had never... And I told myself, Paco, how come you don't know about this? You're supposed to know so many things about martial arts. And then I realized my own ignorance. Thank you, David. But it was very interesting because the sticky hands exercise is very different. It's very free. It doesn't seem to have fixed positions. But actually, in Chu Sheng Tin, the Chi Sao looks the same. It looks very free with movable elbow, not fixed elbow like we do. And it amazes me how different it is. And yet, we're practicing the same fundamental skill about movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the fixed elbow stuff is, I think it's like a good building block to learn how to build your structure, right? To stack your structure on itself. To use not Chu Sheng Tin lineage sort of terminology, but rather Yili Chuan terminology, you have different points in your body that you want to sort of learn to stack on top of each other and to unify them, right? And those are bones and those are really parts in your skeleton, right? But it's really the muscle and the fascia that kind of hold them in place and make them move. So I think initially from my experience, speaking strictly from my experience, right, I've found that keeping a fixed elbow initially it helped me feel the connection fascially and with muscles to the rest of my body. John Kaufman had a great set of principles that I think really guided me, not just with Wing Chun, but they're great life principles as well. And so the first one was just maintain your structure. You don't have your structure, you don't have anything. So if you go too limp, you're too relaxed, you lose your structure, right? So first and foremost, maintain your structure. Once you have your structure, relax within your structure, right? If you can't stay relaxed within your structure, you're not going to generate good force transmission from the rest of your body through your hand, right? It can't be expressed. You can't move. You're too stiff. Somebody can take advantage of you, right? And number three, give yourself freedom to move, right? So once you have structure and you're relaxed within the structure, now you have to explore the movement opportunities and potential without sacrificing the other two. And I think those were those really stuck with me throughout the years in terms of martial arts, life, what have you. They're great sort of boiled down concepts to go by.
By the way, Dan, he's mentioning a priceless list of teachers and principals. So in the notes of the episode, we'll make sure we list these names with all the links so our listeners can research more.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would really like to see that too. I'd love to check out everyone that David's mentioned and just have a chance to visually look at some videos, do some reading, see what it's all about. I'm wondering, it sort of feels like we're moving towards the end of the conversation here, and this has been so great. I have to say that, David, if you'll do us the honor, you need to come back again, because I have 50 questions from what you've said, and I've asked three, and I think Paco's asked three. So we've got a lot more to dive into the details. And I wanted to mention something that surprised me, and I was wondering if you had thoughts on this, which is when we were setting up this conversation, because you knew Paco, and I had never met you or talked with you, and we only had a few minutes before the conversation, I had a preconceived notion of how this conversation might go based on the knowledge that you had done all of these different martial arts, some of them with a specific focus on, again, that word internal martial arts practice. And, I've looked at your Instagram and I've noticed, a lot of your great movement there. But I've been very surprised by this conversation because I had, I had this image of what you might say and how you might approach these topics and your practice, but actually it seems like You're coming at it from almost a completely different perspective of how all of these things interlock and interweave and how you use them and bring them into your life. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I really thought, hey, this might be a more new agey kind of thing, or it might be a more like Eastern Tai Chi type of conversation. But in our conversation, everything you've talked about has been so rooted in practical, real life stuff. And I'm just curious if you've talked with other people and they've been surprised by that, or if you have surprised yourself through studying these things and seeing that there's a much more practical, a different approach and a different way of thinking about a lot of these internalized concepts than I think what people like myself with just a cursory knowledge might assume. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it was sort of hard earned in the sense that, you know, when I started out with all these interests in internal arts, I wavered a lot. I initially, like I said, I was a kid and I was fascinated with all, like you said, the new agey stuff, because I didn't understand the practicality of it myself. And then once I started to delve more into jujitsu and all the other stuff, I just didn't see that it had any place in martial arts, the internal stuff. And then over time, you know, I started to give up on the concept of internal arts because I was like, you know, this is silly. You've got jujitsu and you've got all this other stuff and that stuff works. And I haven't seen anybody apply this internal stuff. And truth is, I wasn't really looking in the right spots, because it's very difficult to find people, like I was saying, who do this internal stuff and who, number one, can use it, and number two, actually want to use it in a fighting context. A lot of people, because it tends to take more of a holistic approach, you know, like I said, I have no interest in ever, you know, trying to work up to fighting in even an amateur bout. You know, I have my livelihood to think about. Like I was talking about, my body's got to function. I would like to function when I'm in my 80s, right? I don't want the brain damage. But so, you know, in terms of, you know, the practicality, I went through the same thing myself. You know, I initially thought it's all new agey stuff. And over the course of like a decade or more, I sort of came to this different nuanced view, you know, that in part is informed by hard science, you know. And the more I read about new research and rehab, physical therapy, pain science, movement science, the more I just, you know, I just see all the correlations or potential correlations to what I've experientially felt training this internal stuff. And so, you know, in terms of, you know, am I surprised? You know, like I've been thinking about this stuff. I think about this stuff all the time. It's my job. It's my passion. I love it. But when I choose to train, right, where I choose to train, I tend to train with people who have a similar outlook and a similar view. So I don't shock people so much. I usually have a different perspective to give people if they ask about it. You know, especially with the science background and my understanding of biomechanics and the body. But generally, I think, you know, it's, you know, to answer your question, I went through the same sort of like 180 turn, you know, from my original expectation of what this is to my own understanding. And you know, I got there by just asking, you know, what is this? What is this? You know, what is, not what do I expect? Because that didn't get me anywhere, you know?
Yeah, you've definitely given us and for sure myself a different perspective. And that's really, really super valuable. Paco, is there anything else that you want to ask or that's on your mind?
No, I just want to add, when we get to touch hands with you and train in the day we meet, when this quarantine is over, and we meet at the studio, that is going to be a treat, because it is a very special thing to feel that. It's just a skill that, unless you have felt, it's very easy to dismiss. And this is a point I wanted to make, because there are people out there doing more externally perceived as practical, external. And they look at some of these, you know, YouTube videos or material about what so-called internal arts, and they're very easy to dismiss. And my point is, experience it, because it will change your life. Not because you have to adopt it, but because you'll realize that it is a very practical thing, but it has an impact in you and how you're able to move. And John Kaufman did this for me. So I'm very, very thankful he gave me that, opened my mind. And, you know, here I am still absolutely devoted to my Wang Xiongliang training under George, but it changed my perspective. It opened my mind that this is a skill that it's very tangible and you have to feel it. So we'll do that when we meet with you. And then the episode can be very practically focused on what we felt, and we can exchange drills and things like that. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Definitely. Likewise.
Yeah. And I love your point about finding good sources. That's very important when you learn anything, because, you know, there are a lot of different sources that purport to teach various things. And with something like this, having a good source material and a good teacher or good people to know who really know their stuff is super important, especially really anything in the martial arts, because it is about also your safety and your physical well-being. You don't want to be deluding yourself or training in ways that might hurt yourself. So it's important to choose wisely and to be judicious. And I'm glad that we'll have all those resources on the webpage for people to check out, all the places you've mentioned, David. And before we go, do you have any tips for people who are interested in pursuing anything that you've talked about in terms of the martial arts, sure. Especially maybe in art, martial art with the quote unquote internal framework? And I would also be interested to hear how, if you have any tips on how you synthesize this very broad base of knowledge that you've practiced. You've practiced, sounds like, almost a dozen or more martial arts, and you have a big background in physical therapy in the body. And any tips on how to synthesize a practitioner's own wealth of knowledge when they're pulling from many sources?
Yeah, definitely. I think to really boil, you know, all those questions down, or at least my answer to all of those questions down into, you know, one concept, is just be clear on what you're looking to get out of whatever you pursue, right? Whether that be a career, a martial art, you know, ask yourself, what's your end game? What's your end goal? Do you want to be able to use this stuff efficiently? Do you not care about that? Do you just want the health aspect? Do you like the social aspect? Does it give you some sort of community, right? Do you need all of that? Do you only need some of that, right? And then, you know, if you've trained, you know, I've trained in a number of disciplines, and I'm certainly not an expert in, I would say, any of them, really. You know, I've trained at best a year and a half in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I never tested for a belt. I've probably done roughly the same time in Muay Thai. I lived in China. I did a little bit of Sancho when I lived there, right? But not an expert in any of this stuff. But at the end of the day, because, you know, I'm clear on my goals, and I wasn't clear on my goals then, but because I'm clear on my goals now, you know, I can retroactively sort of think about the principles that I learned and what sort of overlaps with each other, which at the end of the day, you know, there are certain tactical things that are always going to be inevitable, that always overlap, right? And, you know, in terms of tactics, you're talking angles, right? Entries. It's generally not a good idea to enter straight on at somebody. You always want to come at some sort of angle, and you want to be familiar with angles, how to uproot somebody, right? There are things that make that easier. But, you know, to really boil it down even more, like I said, it's just good movement, right? Good movement is behind every successful martial artist, right? And so just be, you know, being clear on what you want to get out of the art, you know, in terms of practical skills. If you want to do jiu-jitsu, you learn how to efficiently move on the ground, and, you know, they always say submission or position before submission, right? Why? Because you have to have good leverage and you have to have good body mechanics, right? So you have to get into that position first, and then the submission is generally a lot easier, right? So if you have good movement, right? So, you know, the underlying thing, like I would say, just to say again, not to beat a dead horse, is just be clear on your goals, right? And that will, I think, take you further than you'd imagine if you're very clear on what you want to get out of things. And that involves a lot of introspection. You have to be very honest with yourself. And it's a lot of soul searching sometimes, more than you have energy for. But I think at the end of the day, you come out with more clarity, and it's always worth it.
That's great. Well, Paco, this and David, this was wonderful. And like I said, hopefully part one of a 10-part series that we're going to get into here. Paco, any last thoughts before we say goodbye to the listeners?
I am just very, very thankful, David, that you took the time to talk to us today. It really is very, very valuable. I'm blown away by this material. I'm going to listen to the podcast myself many, many times. And we just want to thank you. Absolutely.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. This is great for me, too.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, guys. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to 1000 Exits. And we'll see you next time. Train hard. Have fun. Be safe.
Everybody out there, be safe. Thank you for your support.